This program is brought to you by the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights in the American Founding. If you'd like to learn more about the James Wilson Institute, please visit jameswilsoninstitute.org. We hope you enjoy the program. Hello and welcome to the Anchoring Truths podcast. I'm your host, Garrett Snedeker. We've all heard some dire statistics about marriage and family life in modern America. Fewer and fewer Americans are marrying, and those that are marrying are getting married later in life. This is having a profoundly negative effect on the number of babies being born as well. How did we end up in this mess, and how do we emerge from it, if at all? No one chronicles this account better than Professor Brad Wilcox. He is the author of the new book, Get Married: Why Americans Should Defy the Elites, Forge Strong Families, and Save Civilization. He is professor of sociology and director of the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia, the Future of Freedom Fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, and a non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He studies marital equality, marital stability, and the impact of strong and stable marriages upon men, women, and children. The author and editor of 6 books, he has written for scientific journals such as the American Sociological Review and the Journal of Marriage and Family, as well as for popular publications such as the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic, and National Review. A Connecticut native, he now lives in Charlottesville, Virginia, with his wife and family. Now, I'm a great admirer of Brad's work, and we've been looking for an excuse to have him on our podcast for years. So his new book provides a fantastic occasion to delve deep into a complex subject, but one where he has a clear and simple remedy. Get married. We hope you enjoy the show. Brad Wilcox, we are delighted to have you on our Anchoring Truths podcast. Much of your previous work focuses on the importance of marriage and family life. What motivated you to undertake this particular book project?
Well, Garrett, I've been studying kind of marriage and family with an eye towards its effect on children. Kind of, I think everyone recognizes is that old idea that, you know, we need to be kind of attending to all this stuff for the sake of the children. But in recent years, as I've been talking to UVA students, particularly UVA women, I've gotten the sense that a lot of young adults today are worried about their prospects for marriage, and especially younger women. And this kind of growing concern, as well as kind of like the demographic projections that we're seeing that are forecasting now that 1 in 3 young adults will never marry, kind of record demographic territory here, Garrett, have led me to kind of shift my focus from kind of marriage and kids really to really marriage and the adults. And so this book is really kind of geared more towards making the case that marriage matters for adults and giving them some encouragement to be more intentional about dating and socializing with an eye towards meeting a potential spouse. And then once they are married, kind of giving them a path towards forging a strong and stable marriage. So again, this is kind of focusing much more on the adult side of the picture. And that's a difference from my earlier work, focusing more on kids and marriage and family structure.
So you begin your book, Get Married, with a discussion of the me decade. And that's the 1970s. But what was so distinctive about this decade, and how has its effects, snowballed into defining marriage as we know it?
So there was really just an amazing turn, I think, as we all know, in the late 60s and 70s towards, you know, what Tom Wolfe called this me decade, where people's own individual desires, dreams, aspirations, quests for fulfillment became much more salient for them, and kind of more classic virtues and values regarding family and marriage, faith, kind of lost ground in this moment in American cultural history. And so that led, among other things, to a decline in the marriage rate and to dramatic increases in the divorce rate as people were focusing, more on what they thought would lead towards happiness and fulfillment. And if there were tensions or difficulties or challenges in their marriage, they were much more inclined just to kind of leave the marriage, break the marital bond. So this is what we saw in the 1970s. And I think what people didn't anticipate is that it led to not just sort of less marriage and more divorce, but even less marital happiness, because kind of the more me-centered approach to married life both in that moment in our nation's history, but also today, tends to lead not to marital success, but to marital failure, because taking a more team-oriented approach to marriage and family life, what I call we before me approach to marriage and family life, is, you know, generally much more conducive to succeeding in this domain than kind of focusing on your own individual desires, often in a more, you know, short-term way.
Mm-hmm. And I'd be remiss if I didn't also note that it's the 1970s where you truly saw the beginning of the two-income household, where women were more and more beginning to take full-time jobs as opposed to remaining as homemakers primarily. But that's also what Professor Tyler Cowen has identified as the decade where, as he describes it, the great stagnation begins, where we start to see diminishing returns to labor productivity. I wonder if there's some kind of thread that you might have noticed in your own research that connects these phenomena.
Well, I think there's certainly a way in which the shift in the 70s towards a more feminist approach and towards greater female labor force participation made women less dependent upon marriage and more likely to steer clear of marriage in the first place or get a divorce, you know, if things were not going well in the marriage in the second place. And there's a complex legacy there of both of the kind of cultural and the labor force shifts that you were just talking about in the 70s, especially. I think on the plus side, we can see that women are able to leave abusive marriages and marriages, you know, where there's some kind of not just physical abuse, but verbal abuse. And on the negative side, I think there's a way in which women and even men in the era too are not as likely to kind of take their vows, you know, their marital vows as seriously. And that led both women and men to sort of see easier outs as acceptable for them, you know, when a more, you know, seemingly attractive alternative came along, mm-hmm. or when, you know, their marriage hit kind of any kind of number of typical challenges that married couples will face. So it's a mixed story there. But as we kind of go forward, I think it's important to sort of know, in terms of thinking about the gender story here, that today we're in a world where we don't see a strong association between whether or not a wife and mother works outside of the home and her marital happiness and mental stability. What we do see is that there's kind of an enduring way in which men's stable employment is an important predictor both of getting married in the first place, staying married in the second place, and then also wives being more happily married if they have kids in the household. So what's interesting is just that there's still, I think, a premium that's being placed on men being employed full-time, even in, you know, the 21st century, even as we have, I think, more flexibility for figuring out how women are going to be navigating, choices around work and family.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I thought was interesting that might have been a coinciding of your research along with Professor Cowen's research is that, you know, if you're a female entering the labor force in the 70s and you're working your way up through the ranks in the 80s and the 90s, you are experiencing much higher sort of percentage gains over, you know, a lower starting point versus, you know, your average male who probably is coming from a long background of having, you know, worked in, you know, perhaps professions that his family and men in his family have worked. You're starting from a much higher base, and so you kind of have the expectation game of, well, you know, my father or his grandfather, you know, had returns to, you know, his labor over and over again. Why am I now, you know, not experiencing those same gains? Meanwhile, if my wife was to work, we would get, you know, an instant doubling of income. I just wonder if, you know, there's something like a phenomenon at work where men were certainly expected to work, but they are not, but, you know, starting in the 70s, they didn't have those same, you know, sort of returns to labor that, you know, an early generation, I'm thinking more specifically about blue collar work than white collar work, which, as you note in the book, the returns to you know, white collar work, certainly, you know, in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s were much greater. But it's in that, you know, more traditional family with a single breadwinner who wasn't working in a field in which, you know, knowledge work, white collar work, was ready to take off, where you see, you know, perhaps the most deterioration of family life.
Yeah, so I think what's important to stress here is that, yes, we are seeing that, particularly for men who don't have college degrees, there has been a relatively stagnant trend in men's income. And what's made that kind of dynamic even worse is we're seeing about, you know, more than one in four men in their prime who are not college educated, not being employed full time. And so men's kind of relative appeal financially, and even their appeal as sort of stable breadwinners, I think has declined, in part because, you know, they're just not doing as well relative to the women in their lives as would have been the case prior to the 1970s. I think this is one reason why we're seeing less marriage, you know, and more divorce, I mean, at least compared to the middle of, you know, of the 20th century in recent American families than, you know, we did in an earlier moment. So again, I think we've got to think about kind of the place of men's position labor force in the last half century in important ways, and recognize the path forward if we're aiming to renew marriage. Mm-hmm. Especially in working class and poor communities, is to revive the fortunes of men in their 20s when it comes to their connection to, you know, decent paying stable jobs. And that's, I think, both a supply and a demand issue. It's making sure that there are enough, you know, sectors of the economy that are there to hire men who are not college educated and give them decent paying jobs. But it's also a supply issue. And I think I've spoken to a number of small business owners in Central Virginia, and they report a great deal of frustration with the number of young men in this area who are not reliably coming to work from, say, 8:30 to 4:30, or, you know, 8 to 4 or 9 to 5 in their manufacturing businesses. So there are new voices on the right and many old voices on the left who are sort of saying this is a problem with, you know, the new economy. And then sort of we're seeing two voices on the right, you know, more of the neoconservative right, who is saying it's a cultural problem. Charles Murray makes this point, for instance, sort of saying working class Americans are not sufficiently committed to the virtue of hard work. And I think it's both a cultural and a supply issue that's facing us. But unless and until we kind of can get more working class and poor young men or men from those communities, you know, stably attached to full-time work, we're not going to see marriage reviving in that, you know, part of our society. And that's where we've seen the biggest decline in marriage from a class-based perspective in poor working class communities. And again, I think a lot of it's about the fact that there are fewer men working full time in decent paying stable jobs.
Yeah, you bring up aptly, I think, in your book, the situation of, let's say you have, you know, you bring up the anecdote of, I think his name is Sean, who earns over $100,000. He's living in the DC area as a military contractor, but he's living a pretty boring life by his own admission. He comes home, he feeds his dog, and he doesn't know, you know, quite what to do with his life other than to go through the motions because he's not married. And I was wondering if, based on what you just, you know, said moments ago, there's maybe an inverse going on where you have somebody who might not be married but is at the lower end of the income scale. And it's largely, though, because there's no motivation to work without the purpose of the earning being to support family life. But what's, you know, what's common through both of those examples is that there's no marriage culture, or at least what might have existed earlier, which was the impetus to get married at an earlier age, which has been removed. And so for certain people, the impetus to work harder would come from, you know, supporting family life. The impetus for maybe full human flourishing, you know, might not come just solely through earning, you know, a six-figure income. It would be to earn that income to support, the kind of family life that gives meaning to, one's endeavors. And so maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit more about how American culture has shifted in recent decades, and, you know, its broader implications for American society.
So I think one of the things we're seeing, so we've talked a bit about sort of the working class and, poor part of this whole story. But it's an important thing to also acknowledge just for middle class and upper class young adults that I think we are seeing some troubling signs in terms of postponement of marriage and probably decline in marriage as well. And that's because in part, I think we're seeing that what I call a kind of Midas mindset is becoming more salient. And what I mean by that is sort of this idea that what really matters in life is education, building your own brand, making money, and especially kind of having, you know, a killer career. And we see this playing out both in, you know, elite discussions about life. There was a piece, classic piece in Bloomberg not too long ago that said, women who stay single and don't have kids are getting richer. And kind of purporting to basically argue that women should steer clear of marriage and motherhood and they're going to do better financially. Now, of course, this article was off the mark in terms of the data. Married women, you know, do much better financially over, you know, over the lifetime than their single peers.
Yes, as you conclusively show in the book.
Yeah. And then we're seeing, too, as you know, kind of right wingers like Andrew Tate of a certain kind, red pill right wingers, arguing that marriage is bad for men financially and otherwise. So what they're kind of missing, though, I think, is a recognition that for the average person, marriage is a great deal financially over time. Women and men in their 50s, about 10 times the assets as their peers who are never married singles. And I think more importantly, what we see is that women and men are about twice as likely to say that they're very happy with their lives compared to their unmarried peers. There's just no question that when it comes to both prosperity and happiness, you know, the path to those two financial and emotional goods runs for most Americans through marriage and not away from it. So again, I think that, but the challenge is that, you know, our culture and even I think our kind of college admissions game these days is encouraging young adults to sort of focus on this Midas mindset rather than on love and marriage. And one concrete example, I was talking to a graduate student here at UVA not too long ago and asking him about his plans for education and career. And he had a very detailed kind of plan about how he was going to approach the next decade of his life, you know, educationally and professionally. And then I asked him, would you like to get married? And he answered strongly in the affirmative. And I said, well, what's your plan about dating, love, and marriage? And I just got a blank look from him. And at that point, I encouraged him to ask someone in his circle out on a date, which, you know, thankfully he did. And then I ended up seeing him at our local church, St. Thomas Aquinas Church in Charlottesville, with a young woman. And, you know, so that at least as of now, I think it's worked out, you know, well. But the point is that most young men, most young women are not being kind of encouraged or challenged to devote the same measure of attention and planning to their love lives as they are currently to the expression of, again, this kind of Midas mindset.
Briefly, while we're on this subject, what is your view of how the courtship before marriage now largely takes place through dating apps in modern American culture? I'm talking about a shift from maybe 10 or 15% 10 years ago for how eventually married couples met to now something north of 50 or 60%, even growing every year over year. I think it's rather quaint. My wife and I, you know, we got married in 2017. We met the old fashioned way, or what used to be the old fashioned way, through friends. That is now quite the exception, not the norm.
Yeah, you are correct, Garrett. And I think certainly dating apps are a good option, you know, as a kind of backstop, I would say. And I have friends who've gotten married recently using dating apps, you know, to good success. And there's also a recent UVA graduate who's got a new app called Keeper, and it's designed to promote marriage and, you know, serious relationships. It's kind of the opposite of basically of Tinder. And he's got AI to kind of help people be steered towards, you know, matches that, you know, work for them on a variety of different levels. So there are some good options there, but in general, I think trying to meet in person is better. We see is that couples who do meet in person, either in a religious context or in college or in some kind of social event where friends are gathering, tend to do better in their marriages than couples who are meeting online, or couples, it turns out, who meet in bars and taverns. So I think there's something about kind of that, you know, maybe if it's a screening issue, or whether it's, you know, a network effect, or just have better information. There's something about meeting in a religious community or in college or in a social setting with friends that it seems more conducive to getting off on the right start. So that's what I would encourage people to do, is try to, you know, meet someone in that context, and also tell your friends and family you're looking to get married, and have them help you meet someone as well in one of those contexts. And that's, I think, the ideal approach today.
Much of your book focuses on the role that elites have played in many respects, damaging society's view of marriage. What specifically is this role played by elites, and how powerful can, you know, the actions of quote unquote dissenting individual citizens be in revitalizing, you know, marriage as an institution, and not just some kind of socially constructed historical practice, the pillars of which can be emphasized or de-emphasized depending on one's individual will?
Yeah, so when I first kind of came out with the book's title, there was a lot of pushback on Twitter from elites, you know, saying, look, Brad, you know, elites tend to marry at higher rates, they tend to stay married, you know, they're living family-centered lives, you know, why are you saying defy elites? And of course, if they, you know, had read the book, which of course they could at that point, but they would recognize, yeah, I acknowledge that. But certainly when it comes to practice, our elites tend to do pretty well on the marriage and family front. But what I'm talking about is their cultural kind of messaging around marriage and family. And the irony is that one of the critics, the early critics of the book's subtitle, was Matt Iglesias, who seems by all accounts to be stably, happily married, you know, with a child, and everything seems great on the home front for them. But he had written a piece for Vox a number of years ago that said, quote, the decline of marriage isn't a problem. So here in his kind of his authoritative role as a, you know, smart journalist in one of the leading progressive platforms, he was kind of advancing a message that was undercutting the value of marriage as a kind of public good for the society as a whole. So he was kind of unwittingly a perfect example of my argument. That is that our elites, they tend to walk right in private and then talk left in public. And I think that's a tragedy because they're not using their cultural authority and power as journalists, as professors, as public school superintendents, as Hollywood moguls and policymakers to advance a kind of more marriage friendly culture and set of public policies that I think would redound to the benefit of ordinary and more vulnerable Americans and their kids.
Just very briefly, I should have asked you to do this earlier in our interview, but what, if you could, what are some defining statistics on marriage in America in 2024 and
sure,
comparisons to, you know, maybe, you know, 40, 50 years ago?
So there's sort of good news and bad news to report about marriage and family in America. I'll start with the bad news. So the bad news, I think, is that we're seeing for adults the closing of the American heart unfold. We're seeing dramatic declines in dating and marriage and childbearing. So concretely, what that means is that the marriage rate's fallen 60%+ since 1970. And we're projecting now that one in three young adults will never marry. This is kind of record demographic territory. And I think very sobering, because for most of us, marriage is a kind of a keystone for our flourishing, both financially and emotionally. We're also seeing fertility come way down to about 1.6 babies per month on average, well below replacement. And that means about 1 in 4 young adults today will never have kids. So on the negative side, I think we're going to see a rising share, a large minority of Americans who are going to be kinless without a spouse and children. And as they move through midlife and later life, I think there's going to be a lot of financial and emotional suffering as a consequence of that. The good news is, partly because family life is more selective, we're actually seeing the share of kids being raised in intact married families ticking upwards since 2012. So divorce is down and non-marital childbearing is steady. And that means, again, that more kids are being raised by intact married families. We're up to about 54% of kids, and that's up from even a few years ago, who are reporting that they were raised by their own married parents across the course of their, you know, childhood. So that's the good news. I think Americans who are more educated, who are more affluent, who are more religious, more conservative, also Asian Americans, as I mentioned in the book, are the kinds of Americans, immigrants as well, who are forging these relatively strong and stable marriages. And, you know, that those groups are groups that I, you know, spotlight as groups to emulate in my new book, Get Married.
Yeah. I was going to ask you how you came to choose those four groups. Did they jump out at you? Have they jumped out at you for years? And to what extent can you be a member of just one of those groups, but still have the, you know, sort of the deck stacked against you?
So I think the challenge that those groups face is that there aren't as many leading cultural, institutions, be it the New York Times or their local public high school, or their generic public university, that are kind of lending cultural support to their efforts to live a family-first way of life. And so you can be a good spouse, you can be a good parent, and I know plenty of cases here like this, and then you send your kid to the local public high school or to the local public university, and it's a disaster, you know, in terms of, you know, your kids are kind of abandoning all of the kinds of values and virtues that you were trying to uphold in your own home. So that's the challenge. And I think the answer to that for conservatives is to advance a kind of pluralistic agenda in the policy arena, where we're giving families more choices when it comes to the schooling of their own children and their higher education options as well. And so, of course, the good news there, Garrett, as you know, is that a number of states are really advancing strong school choice measures that give more family-oriented, you know, couples with kids, you know, more options for the rearing of the next generation.
As a reminder, we're talking with Brad Wilcox, author of the new book, Get Married. Brad, you perform an admirable service in the book in comparing the happiness of married from unmarried people in the U.S., and you use surveys and income data to demonstrate this most clearly in an apples-to-apples comparison. I want to read for our listeners an anecdote from your book that I think does a fine job in a rather economical way of showing this. Quote, "Marriage is a much more powerful predictor of happiness than two other factors that many young adults think will bring them happiness, work and money. Having a job only boosts your odds of being happy by 50%, and above average income only boosts them by 88%. Marriage is associated with a 151% increase in your odds of being happy compared to being never married. In fact, two economists found that a stable marriage was estimated to be worth approximately $100,000 per year of extra happiness compared to being widowed or separated," end quote. So I think you show convincingly the fallacy that the elites we were just discussing espouse, that marriage diminishes the happiness of the average person, when those elites focus on, you know, anecdotal data for especially high earners or idiosyncratic individuals. But I wanted to ask you a more nuanced question about the difference between perhaps those individuals who are chronically single versus those who get married.
Sure.
How much self-selection is at work here? Perhaps are there many people who are making themselves bad mates through self-destructive practices such as poor socialization or isolation? And related to this, phenomenon of self-selection, how much is Charles Murray's observation of modern American mating patterns based off of self-sorting on cognitive lines having an effect?
Yeah, great questions. So I think we have to, and here I'm going to punt a little bit and just sort of say it's both, right? So I think there's no question the kinds of people today who are getting married tend to be more socially adept, more educated, more affluent, you know, maybe more physically attractive, more religious. I mean, you could imagine a number of different factors that would sort of be consistent broadly with what we call the sort of selection effect story in understanding, you know, mating and marriage in American family life today. So those are the kinds of things that might be associated with increasing your odds of getting married today. And at the same time, though, I think we do see, based upon work done by like the economists Sean Grover and John Helliwell, that it looks like there are, you know, sort of their causal effects from marriage on happiness. I mean, they're looking at kind of controlling for happiness prior to marriage, comparing those folks who get married and those folks who don't marry, trying to look at folks who are roughly similar in terms of, you know, education and other background characteristics, and then kind of tracking them over time. And seeing that the folks who get married tend to have higher levels of happiness, especially in midlife, when a lot of us kind of hit bottom happiness-wise. And then I would sort of say, from a kind of more of a theoretical perspective, the reason I think that marriage matters is that, you know, we just have someone in our corner, someone to talk to, someone to encourage us, someone to give our lives meaning and purpose. There, you know, your life is more structured even when you're married with kids than when you don't have a spouse and children. It's just a fuller life. It often can be stressful. It just kind of, you know, you've got dinner and, you know, school, plays and soccer and people who are religious, you know, church on Sunday, and all these things kind of lend a certain meaning, direction, and purpose to people's lives that tends to redound to their benefit. So I think that's certainly part of a causal story that we would see playing out today. And even we're seeing two reports that physical touch, Garrett, is declining in contemporary American life, and that's not good for us. We are actually animals. And I just got a puppy as a side note, and I've been amazed at how much my puppy wants to cuddle in the morning. And so, you know, the benefit of being a spouse and parent, among other things, is there's just a lot more physical touch in your daily life. I think that's good for us as well. So I think there's a causal story, but there's also a selection story. We just need to acknowledge both are important. And that also means, too, I think for young adults to do more to kind of encourage them to develop the kinds of virtues that would make them, you know, more appealing as a potential spouse. And so I think, you know, I've heard Rob Henderson, for instance, a promising young psychologist, encouraging guys to, you know, focus on their grooming, focus on physical fitness, have a sense of their own mission, like what is their purpose they're aiming for. And I would add to that just the importance for young men of being more intentional about their education and their work. Don't have to figure it all out at this point in your life. That would be kind of the Midas mindset.
Yeah.
But I do think there are too many young men that I'm acquainted with who don't have a kind of clearer sense of where they're headed and what kinds of, you know, skills and gifts they're trying to cultivate, and then also what kind of job path they're seeking to pursue in their early 20s. So these are all things that would help, I think, people flourish more when it comes to dating and marriage as well.
There are some destructive government policies hindering rather than helping Americans choose marriage. For example, you write about tax and welfare policies. Quote, more than 1 in 10 unmarried Americans with incomes less than $50,000 a year report that one reason they're steering clear of marriage is that they would lose their government benefits, according to a 2021 family survey. What are some others that come to mind?
So when it comes to some of the obstacles that, you know, government policy puts in the pathway of ordinary Americans on the marriage and family front, certainly marriage penalties are a big deal. I've talked to a number of couples now who are cohabiting with young kids. And the reason they're doing that is because mom's on Medicaid. And if they were to marry and report their joint income, they would lose Medicaid, and they don't have health insurance provided through their place of work. So that's an obvious, I think, challenge. And we've got to address those marriage penalties in our means tested programs. I think housing is an obstacle too in a lot of our metro areas with high demand and relatively low supply. So I think thinking about reforming zoning laws to make building, especially single family housing, easier is part of the answer here. And I think trying to think too, of more and more ways to reduce the cost of education, partly through school choice measures, but also reforming public education to create more value, more accountability for teacher performance, and reducing administration, both in public schools, elementary, middle, and high schools, but also in public universities that are often bloated with administrators who are just making the cost of college education skyrocket. So these would all be things that would kind of reduce the cost of housing and education for families, and that would be a help. And then too, I think thinking about some kind of more generous child tax credit geared towards working middle-class families that would have even a marriage bonus. I've suggested a 20% marriage bonus to encourage marriage among working middle-class Americans as well. These are the kinds of policies that I think would be helpful for.
Unfortunately, that would not be retroactive for those people who got married in the last decade. Such as my wife and me,
but it would be effective going forward, so that you would benefit, sort of if we were to pass such a policy this year or in the next Congress. Yes, exactly.
I think it's the conclusion of your final chapter. It's not the actual conclusion of your book. You make a stirring call for a pox on both houses or both political parties in the country. You write, "They have not sought to protect or renew the educational, economic, and cultural foundations of family life by pursuing, for instance, anything close to a family wage. They have not eliminated barriers to family formation like the working class marriage penalty. And they've not pursued policies that make it easier for parents to maximize their investments of time and money in their children rather than the workplace. Too often, the family has been orphaned by our political class. What has been the biggest barrier to common sense policymaking, in your view?"
Well, I think the challenge here is that the right kind of assumes that a small state, or has assumed that the sort of a small state is always kind of the best thing, hasn't kind of taken seriously that more Aristotelian or more Thomistic notion that, that law and policy exist in part to advance the common good. Mm-hmm. And that good encompasses obviously strong and stable families and marriage in particular. So I think being more cognizant of the need to rethink things like divorce law, to rethink the way in which we approach welfare policy, even when it comes to housing. I think there are some free market conservatives who don't really want to do too much in the housing, department. They think that's more of a matter just for the market to handle. Or even on this issue of kind of industrial policy. I mean, we're not going to go back to 1950, obviously, in terms of the share of Americans who are employed in manufacturing. But I think we should be thinking about, how our economy is or is not kind of friendly to working class Americans in terms of, employment patterns and trends. Especially working class men who've been floundering of late, like I mentioned earlier. So I think conservatives haven't kind of been attentive enough to the way in which, law and policy can advance marriage and family. On the left side, I think the problem is they tend to think that family policy basically means handing over more and more functions from the family to the government. So they're often enamored of, free childcare or more pre-K or, other measures like that, that tend to just sort of take functions that once were held within the bonds of the home and just sort of taking them out of the family and just giving them over to the state, not recognizing that if you kind of just hand over all the functions of family to the state, you kind of divest it of its sort of meaning and purpose and value for ordinary people. And that over time, people will, I think, be less inclined to invest in marriage and childbearing if, there's really nothing happening on the home front. And it's also, of course, not there's often a class bias here that I've written about repeatedly, and that is that upper middle class Americans tend to, for instance, want publicly provided subsidized childcare, but working class and poor Americans are much more inclined to think the family should be providing care for babies and toddlers. You know, so there's also, ironically here, kind of the upper middle class or rich folks are more inclined to, you know, at least when it comes to childcare, embrace the status agenda, and more ordinary working, you know, class Americans are more likely to want policy options that are more family friendly. So I think when it comes to things like, you know, helping families with work and family, we should just basically rely upon a generous child tax credit and let families make a choice for themselves about how best to spend that money. For some, it will be, you know, daycare. For some, it'll be a nanny. But for a large share of Americans, it would be, you know, using that money to have a, you know, a parent stay at home or work part time and provide more care either from the parents or even, you know, maybe a grandparent as well.
I was heartened to hear you just now bring up an Aristotelian Thomistic frame to this discussion, because although your, you know, research that you employ in the book is that of a sociologist, there is, I think, considerable overlap between the applicability of your own work and the work we do at the James Wilson Institute, which focuses on first principles of moral and legal reasoning through the natural law. You know, Aquinas said that the purpose of law is to lead people to virtue, not suddenly, but rather gradually. And I think that shot through your book is a recognition that there is an important role to play for law to encourage those individuals who are, you know, not in a position to really have the wisdom of the ages. You know, there's a role for the law to play in encouraging marriage and family formation. However, this is, you know, in modern America being done, you know, without the backdrop of a religious culture that existed decades earlier. It's not like you can ignore the natural law. The joke we like to make is that, you know, you ignore the natural law at your own detriment, because it will come crashing in on you or you violate its precepts. But how do you see, you know, this culture, which has kind of fallen away from religiosity and maybe, you know, an implicit, you know, reverence or acknowledgement of natural law? How do you see it you know, perhaps undermining the goals that, you know, you outline in the book?
Yeah, so I mean, I think there's just been a kind of, I mean, on the left, clearly a blindness about kind of the role of something like natural law or resistance to it, obviously. But I think on the right, oftentimes a kind of commitment to a more limited government perspective, one that seeks to minimize the reach and power of the state and minimize, you know, regulations that would affect, you know, our common life, has made the right often, you know, unable to sort of see how in some cases and contexts, law and policy can advance the common good, including the goods related to marriage and family. So I think the kind of work that you're doing is helpful to kind of educating lawyers, professors, and other kinds of, you know, culture shapers about the ways in which natural law and some kind of understanding of the common good can be powerful in shaping how we do lawmaking, policymaking, bureaucratic regulations going forward. At the same time, I think, you know, I am sympathetic to this idea that, you know, conservatives have articulated in recent decades, which is that we don't want an overweening state that doesn't give us kind of sufficient room to exercise virtue on our own, you know, or under our own power, so to speak. So I was talking, for instance, to the leader of a Catholic family group in Europe, and you know, he was saying that he has some respect for what's happening in Hungary, for instance, but he also thinks there isn't much room in sort of the Hungarian political order right now to make space for civil society. It's basically the state is the sort of primary engine of the good life in Hungary. And so I think we can kind of oscillate between extremes, right? Where, you know, the left wants the state to kind of do too much according to its own agenda. And there are other folks who want this on the right, cultural right, wants the state to do, I think, too much as well. And so the challenge for conservatives, in my view, is to recognize the via media here where, you know, the sort of the basic legal and policy framework and bureaucratic framework is a lot more family friendly, you know, going forward than it has been in the last 40 years in American life. But we're not aiming to kind of have the state itself become, you know, the primary driver of family life and of, you know, of our social life more generally, that that's where, you know, families and civil society and the market, you know, should be the primary, you know, drivers of what happens in our society, at the same time recognizing that our state could do better to facilitate stronger families and the common good.
No, that's well said. So towards the end of your book, you want your readers to come away with what you call the five C's, which are the virtues that you describe the masters of marriage, the strivers, the Asian Americans, conservatives, and those who are faithful, sort of the values that they embody. And you write, quote, "We must instead encourage young men and women, along with middle-aged husbands and wives, navigating the challenges and occasional doldrums of marriage and family life, to reject the me-first ethos of our culture and open their hearts to a we-first approach to love and marriage built around the distinctive values and virtues embodied by these masters of marriage." So our listeners can you know, have a takeaway after this episode. What are the five C's, and why do you think that they are, you know, the most important virtues that are demonstrated by those who have, you know, more broadly, you know, demonstrated successful marriages?
Yeah. So in the book, I talk about five C's, and those are communion, children, commitment, cash, and community. And what I mean by that is, I mean, those five C's, when it comes to communion, kind of fostering a we before me mindset on everything from, you know, joint accounts. So we have actually really good experimental evidence now, Garrett, that couples who are randomly assigned to joint accounts do better in the first 2 years of marriage than couples who are randomly assigned to separate accounts. I think that's just because when you have, you know, shared pot of money, you know, as a couple, you're talking more about your financial decisions together. You have a sense that your future together as a couple financially is knit, you know, together in your marriage. And people are not kind of sort of squirreling away, you know, money for themselves or making decisions about, you know, their own accounts that might come back to hurt the integrity of their marriage. So that's an example of kind of communion. I also talked to you about in that chapter on communion, the value of regular date nights, you know, fostering that intimacy in marriage that's important to keep strong, especially when you've got kids who can, you know, make it hard for you to have those alone moments. But when it comes to the second C, children, just recognizing that your marriage matters not just for you and even for your spouse, but for your kids. And so you're kind of attentive to the ways in which you're trying to keep your marriage strong, for the benefit and part of any kids that you might have in the marriage as well. Also talk in that chapter about kind of the benefits of doing things together, both fun things as a family, but also hard things like Saturday morning chores for us, at least, are always a chore, literally, metaphorically. But what we do see in the research that I did for the book is that couples who do chores with their kids are more happily married, and actually more the bigger story there than just fun stuff. So that's interesting. On the third C, commitment, just kind of having people recognize that, kind of keeping the D word out of their minds and their conversation. Divorce, obviously, is what I'm talking about here, is helpful for forging a strong and stable marriage, you know, recognizing that most couples have tough times. And so when those tough times arrive on your marital doorstep, you know, your first recourse is not to think about an easy out, but working through, you know, your challenges with your spouse. Also, when it comes to commitment, just the importance of fidelity. And there are a lot of, I think, distractions in our culture today, both in person, but even more so online for people, and just encouraging, you know, husbands and wives not to follow their old flame on Facebook or Insta or whatever it might be. And also not to wander down electronic pathways that are going to, you know, lead them to, you know, put their marriage in jeopardy in one way or another, too, in the chapter on commitment. Chapter on cash talks about the value of, you know, a steady stream of income, stable employment, shared assets are all kind of important for marriages. And it turns out it's particularly the husband's stable employment that matters more for the marriage than the wife's, you know. And one statistic striking there from Harvard, Sasha Killewald has found that, you know, when the wife lost her job, no effect on divorce. When the husband lost his job, 33% increased risk of divorce, kind of illustrates the point. So something about the husband's stable employment is especially important for the financial foundations of today's marriages. And finally, community. Birds of a feather flock together. And so, you know, if you've got good friends, either friends who are married or friends who are single, but kind of honor your marriage, you know, give good example on this front, you know, talk about their spouses respectfully in public and even in private, obviously, and, you know, are trying to do a good job as husbands and wives, fathers and mothers, you know, or if they're single, you know, living good lives in one way or another, your odds of succeeding in marriage, much higher. But if your friends are, you know, trash talking their boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife, if they're doing things, you know, they shouldn't be doing in one way or another on, you know, on the marriage front, if, you know, they're just not living, if they're career obsessed or, you know, whatever else it might be. I mean, we can kind of fill in the blank there, alcohol, drugs, you know, whatever, then your odds of failing at marriage are much higher. And we've got good empirical evidence that divorce is heavily networked, for instance, on this point from Nicholas Christakis at Yale University. And so the example that I give in the chapter on community is just that if you're got a religious bone in your body, it would definitely encourage couples to, you know, attend church, synagogue, temple, mosque, you know, whatever is part of their religious tradition as a couple. And when you do that, what we see is that you're more likely to be surrounded by people who are trying to do their best to be good spouses and good family folks. And that dramatically increases your odds of marital stability, marital happiness, and even frequent sex, which is probably one of the more surprising findings in the book. So that's the religion and community story at the end of the book, but it's all a part of the value of community and its importance in forging a strong and stable marriage today.
So the five C's, very important for both the married and the unmarried, we could say.
Yes. If we're on the unmarried, recognizing that as you kind of look towards marriage, you know, you can sort of found your marriage on the five C's, and that increases your odds of marital happiness. And, you know, against the critique of someone like Andrew Tate, minimizes your risk of ending up in divorce court.
Again, we've been deeply grateful to be speaking with Brad Wilcox, author of Get Married. Brad, where can our listeners follow your work in addition to, of course, buying the book, which we heartily recommend?
I'm on Twitter, Brad Wilcox, IFS, and then familystudies.org is a great website for a lot of different family scholarship. We've got new blog posts Monday through Thursday, and then a lot of other research briefs and reports on the blog, familystudies.org, that I think your readers would enjoy taking a look at.
Fantastic. We'll link to IFS in the show notes and make sure that our listeners are pointed in the direction towards your Twitter and where they can buy the book. Thank you so much, Brad. A deeply enlightening podcast episode, and we hope to see you again soon.
Okay. Thanks, Garrett. Have a great day.
This program has been brought to you by the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights and the American Founding. If you'd like to learn more about the James Wilson Institute, please visit jameswilsoninstitute.org. Thanks for listening.